Thank you very much, Professor Paltarovich.
Could I help you, Professor, to depress
yes,
the button?
Yes, here we are. Yeah. And my friend, Director Shaken, my friends. What I thought I would do today is, in a tradition that I have been pursuing over visits to the Moscow School of Economics over several years now, which is to give you kind of an informal picture, so far as I understand it, of the economic and political situation presently in the United States at a moment of really intense interest for reasons that I will come to. And just to use a little bit of the analytical foundation that I have worked on developing with my own students at the University of Texas over the past 25 years, that is intended to provide a factual basis for assessing the relevance of the question of economic inequalities to a range of issues, and in this case, to the evolving political conditions in the United States. Now, that's only a small part of the mosaic that I would like to sketch for you this afternoon, but I will come to it in due course. Well, political life in the United States has been, I think it's fair to say, quite interesting over the past few years. And in 2016, as you are probably aware, we elected one of the more unusual characters to the presidency of the United States, a hotel and real estate speculator and manager by the name of Donald Trump, narrowly over Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, Senator, and First Lady, in a contest that even by the relaxed standards of 21st century American politics was marked by a very high degree of personal invective, accusations of unfitness, accusations of criminal behavior, accusations of character flaws on both sides, accusations of the mismanagement of state resources, in particular classified information, all kinds of allegations and bitter personal attacks characterized that campaign. But that wasn't what resolve the issue, I think. I think it's fair to say that when you take a cold look at the outcome of that campaign, it was substantially decided by economic forces and by an ongoing cultural and economic divide inside the United States. And a very major piece of this, oh, sorry, this is going too far, was the division between the cities and the countryside and between the coasts and the interior of the United States, which is illustrated very effectively on this map, where the counties are mapped in blue if they voted for the Democratic candidate and in red if they voted for the Republican. And you can see that the Democratic vote is urban, it is coastal, and it is along the frontiers of the country. It's basically not in the interior at all. And that reflects both a polarization of perceptions about economic and social conditions in the United States, as well as a very radical unevenness that has been developing in the U.S. for a long time, since the mid-1970s, I would say, at the latest, but greatly accentuated in the wake of the great financial crisis of 2007-2009, which produced a radical decline, further decline, in the manufacturing base traditionally located in the upper Midwest of the country, and a recovery, very strong recovery and a successful recovery in the coastal regions, which are on the one hand oriented toward finance, insurance, real estate, and so forth in the east, and toward advanced technology, aerospace, military technologies, information technologies in the far west, in California, Washington State, and Oregon. And it's so it's fair to say that Hillary Clinton campaigned from the perspective of one part of the country, which she was familiar with and which in which her political base had been developing for 25 years since the onset of her husband's administration in the early 1990s. And Donald Trump campaigned from the perspective of the other part. And it would have been exceedingly difficult, even if she were a more flexibly minded and more tactically effective politician than she proved to be, for her or for anyone else to bridge the gap of perceptions. What Trump did was to campaign, and he won, in the stagnant and declining rural and suburban regions, and crucially in the upper Midwest, which had been voting for the Democratic candidate consistently for about 30 years since the mid-1980s, since the Reagan administration, but which where you had a series of states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, which were always divided, and you can see in these states the red and the blue are both present, that they were always divided, but where the demographic forces and the forces of industrial decline had tipped the advantage to the conservative regions of those states and given them an effective control over the state governments and eventually over the outcome in the Electoral College. And this was because of the decline of advanced manufacturing, machine tool business, and machinery, and automobiles that had been going on since the late 1970s and early 1980s, which had created, I think it's fair to say, in those regions, a psychology of loss and victimization. So Donald Trump was elected president. Hillary Clinton was defeated, basically because the three states that I just mentioned switched from being traditionally Democratic to being, at least by very small margins in this election, victories for the Republican Party. Interesting question now is what has happened in the aftermath. And I think it is fair to say that both parties have had difficulty adjusting to the new situation. The Republican Party, because Donald Trump represents something quite different from what one might call the traditional policy positions of the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party, even more seriously, because in the wake of having been defeated even narrowly, it has proved unwilling or unable to adjust its political strategy or its economic message. Again, structural reasons for doing so. If it were to adjust in order to try to appeal effectively to the voters who went over to the Republicans in the last election, it would have to some degree, repudiate its own past policies and, if not deny, at least de-emphasize the record of success which has brought it strong majorities in the regions of the country that it continues to dominate. So it's a problem of an impasse in political strategy, as well as a problem of mentality insofar as the Democratic Party has become a party of urban professionals, Wall Street financiers, Hollywood fundraising types, and this kind of an information technology gurus, and has essentially no longer any significant base in trade unions or working class sensibilities. So it's both extremely difficult culturally and from an analytical standpoint to work out a strategy of recovering the votes that cost it the election in 2016. So what has the Democratic Party done in the last couple of years? The answer is it has externalized its defeat. It has attempted to find culprits, to find scapegoats. Some of them are internal. This is a rush of blaming the former director of the FBI, Mr. Comey, for having reopened an investigation into Hillary Clinton's missing State Department emails in the period just before the campaign. And above all, a campaign of blaming a certain foreign power that I shall not be so impolite as to name in this precinct. No, of blaming Russia for having done an amazing array of exceedingly ingenious things to persuade American voters that they should vote for Trump rather than Clinton, as though the American voter did not have his or her own reasons in the various parts of the country that Trump carried for making that particular choice. So we have accusing fingers pointing at Russia and specifically at President Putin, with the dual purpose of deflecting blame from the leadership of the Democratic Party and also of forging an alliance, I think it's fair to say, with forces that are structurally anti-Russia within the United States government in the intelligence and foreign policy networks and agencies, and whose goal, of course, was to undermine the apparent policy objective of the incoming president, Mr. Trump, which was to try and normalize and deflate the hostilities that had developed under President Obama with Russia and also, to some degree, with China. So the result has been, for 2 years now, so far, investigations which have have taken a large share of American media attention, but which have proved substantially fruitless in fact. Several trials have occurred largely of peripheral figures on peripheral matters such as tax violations or violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act and similar matters that don't bear in any directly provable way on the conduct of the presidential campaign. Two indictments, as you, I'm sure, are aware, of Russian nationals, one in relation to the Internet Research Agency of St. Petersburg. I trust none of you are financing your degrees by working for that particular business. And one of them of alleged agents of the GRU. Trials which, indictments which can never be brought to trial since the defendants will not appear in American court. And a great deal of time, which I think it's fair to say has been wasted, and of expectations which are destined to be disappointed as these investigations, I would predict, and many people in the U.S. would contradict me, but I will predict that they will come to a conclusion or to a lack of conclusion over time, without yielding the so-called smoking gun or definitive political blow to the current incumbent of the White House that many people in the Democratic Party have been hoping for. And meanwhile, as a result of what was this fairly, I think, effective application of a stable policy of promotion of economic recovery in the final years of the Obama administration, the strength, the underlying strength of American social insurance institutions, and measures that have been taken already in this administration, the overall economy has continued to grow. It has continued to grow, and it has, I'll come to more detail momentarily, but some of the edge has probably come off some of the lingering discontent in the regions that propelled Mr. Trump to the White House. If that had happened under Hillary Clinton presidency, which it probably would have, it would have benefited her. But it seems to me that under the present circumstances, it's likely to benefit Mr. Trump because he's, after all, the incumbent as these developments are occurring. Economic growth has indeed continued. It's even accelerated so that we're now looking at growth rates in the 3 to 4% range, at least for a period of time. And the reason for that is substantially, in the first place, reductions in the corporate tax rate, which have approximately reduced the taxation of corporate profits in half from, if my memory is correct, from about $400 to about $200 billion per year, expanding total retained earnings by about 10%, and especially five-year expensing provisions in the tax code, which provide special benefits for new business investments. So there's been a great deal of tax incentivized purchasing manufacturing of equipment. And a lot of that is energy-based equipment, which is going into promoting the production of oil and gas, especially in the Permian Basin region of West Texas, which is becoming and is now a major center, the major center of tight oil, tight gas, shale oil, of fracking. That is a phenomenon which probably does not improve living standards all that much, but it prevents a decline that might otherwise occur and keeps energy prices in the United States very much under control. Employment is, by the standard measure of the unemployment rate, at very high levels. That is to say, the rate is lower than it has been in almost half a century. But one has to allow that the working population is smaller than it was 10 or 15 years ago in relation to total population. Many more people have taken early retirement or otherwise dropped out of the labor force thanks to the availability of early retirement under Social Security and health insurance for the elderly under Medicare. Debts are various kinds, household debts, consumer debts, credit card debt, automobile debt, have been rising, also mortgages in most recent times. But that phenomenon is probably more broadly based and diffuse than it was either in the late period of the 1990s, when it was heavily concentrated in information technology, or in the mid period of the 2000s, when it was heavily concentrated in fraudulent mortgages that were extended to people who it was known at the time would not be able to repay those loans. So while there are some indications of debt-related stress in the economy, I so far have not encountered evidence that any imminent retrenchment is probable. And that would suggest that the underlying growth of consumer spending powering the economy has some time to go. And since economic memories are short and people have now, by now, largely forgotten or have sublimated the events of 10 years ago to more recent events, this too should benefit the Republicans at the expense of the Democrats. And finally, as you are probably aware, this administration has launched on highly visible and very aggressive trade wars and financial measures, as well as sanctions. They are so far relatively small in their impact, I will come. I'll talk a little bit more about their political effects. I think their symbolic value is substantial, and they are widely seen in the United States as an assertion of American power and support of American jobs in an economy, particularly amongst people who, as I said a few minutes ago, had developed a psychology of victimization, whether it was justified or not. And the Federal Reserve, now under the leadership of a Trump appointee, has embarked on a course of raising interest rates, which has the effect of bringing money into the country, of bringing commodity prices down, bringing the exchange, the dollar up in relation to emerging market countries, in relation to the rand and the peso and the Turkish lira and I suppose the Russian ruble. And all of that has the effect of supporting the purchasing power of American households. With that backdrop, you have to have lived in the United States for the last couple of years to have experienced and get a feel and to have maybe a longer political horizon as well to get a feel for how chaotic the political situation has been. This is an administration which has already had two secretaries of state, three national security advisors, several heads of the National Economic Council, an ongoing internal war with the Justice Department, clear open hostility with past directors of the Central Intelligence Agency, and which has been subjected to a degree that I simply can't recall, to daily pummeling in the mainstream press, the Washington Post, the New York Times, as well as a number of the cable networks, CNN, as well as MSNBC and so forth. So it's a the hallmarks I would describe, I would suggest, of ongoing struggles for power in to some degree in the domestic, but especially in the foreign policy sphere, which I would broadly characterize as very aggressive civilians seeking global economic and political advantage, also in some cases to use the United States government for various ulterior purposes, and that as against relatively realistic and cautious military, a professional military, which has been I think strongly affected by the real world experience of having its forces bloodied and stalemated in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as more recently in Syria. So is rather aware of the consequences for them of being thrown recklessly into situations that are not easily handled. This is actually the opposite of the situation that characterized the kind of American internal political economy when I was much younger at the time of the Vietnam War. At that time, the military officials who were military officers who were veterans of World War II were extremely aggressive. And we see in the New York Times a few days ago that they even in 1968 made plans to bring nuclear weapons to South Vietnam for use in the battle over Khe San. Whereas the civilians, who were also veterans of World War II, were much more cautious. The civilians had been junior officers in that war and who in the Second World War and who had grown up under the nuclear threat were the restraining force. Today, I think it's the military officers who are the restraining force and the civilians who have forgotten the power of the weapons that they are playing with. In the area, though, of trade and financial policy, the military does not figure. And so aggressive players tend to dominate. I think that's the essence of that political economy problem. And so we have a politics of sanctions and tariffs which are designed for a number of different purposes. One of them has been, I think, achieved quite successfully is to wring concessions from weaker players. Canada and Mexico, and what was just the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, in which, if one reads the fine print, one discovers that Canada has given up the right to negotiate a free trade agreement or trade agreement with any other country, notably with non-market economy, with any non-market economy, that is to say with China, without getting first the approval of the United States, a sacrifice of sovereignty that Canada had not made before. Similarly, with respect to Iran, the effect of the policy was to successfully force German firms to retreat and others to retreat from their investments in that country because they feared losing access to the American economy. The second purpose of the sanctions in other cases is to inflict lasting damage with the objective ultimately, however far-fetched it may seem, of regime change, and that is, I think, fair to say, certainly what is being, what is contemplated with respect to Iran, and is contemplated by some with respect to Russia. And then to also to set back economic integration and to change the terms of competition, and that's the objective with respect to China. This is not a policy which is going to be, at least in the eyes of those who are the policy designers, going to be one that is easily negotiated away, because the objective is a fundamental change in the balance of economic activity between ourselves and, in the case I just mentioned, of the Chinese. Something which, as a former advisor to China, I think is exceedingly unlikely to be achieved. With the result that so long as the policy is in place, the level of hostility is simply going to ratchet upward. And I would add to this that we're seeing an ongoing return to right-wing governments in South America following 15 years or so of social progress and relative political independence on that continent, while the exact role of the United States government and what's happening in Brazil and what has happened in Argentina and elsewhere is, I think, something that will be revealed only with time. The history of let's say, intervention is there for anybody to examine. And then there's the financial weapon, which is being wielded very aggressively, the U.S. interest rates causing financial difficulties, stress, declining currencies, as I mentioned earlier, from Turkey to Argentina to South Africa and elsewhere. And I would just characterize the whole story as one of a generally effective use of economic and financial power in the short run, which in a domestic news environment that is characterized by the incessant invocation of threats from Iran, from China, and especially from Russia, a country, as I think I've said many times, of evil geniuses intent on the very destruction of American democracy and of our way of life, as I'm sure you all are aware, this is viewed and may well be viewed widely in the United States as a robust defense of the American, not only of the American position, but of the American prerogative to set the course for the rest of the world. So we're coming up in a month's time on a midterm election. Basic facts of that event, I think, are determined by this underlying background of the economic climate, relatively favorable, the chaotic political environment, which is viewed in very different ways in different parts of the country, and a basic geometry of the geometry and geography of the election situation in the two houses. In the Senate, because senators are only elected, one-third of the Senate is elected every 2-year cycle, there is a great imbalance in this election. 32 senators are facing, or 32 Senate seats are up, but 24 of them are already held by Democrats and only 8 by Republicans. And the result of that is that it's exceedingly unlikely that the Democrats can pick up even the 1 or 2 seats that they need in order on a net basis to take control of the Senate. It's not impossible, but they would have to hold every one of the 24 seats they presently hold, and there are some vulnerable incumbents in North Dakota and New Jersey and elsewhere, and they'd have to defeat an offsetting number of the 8 Republicans, and there are not that many of those that are vulnerable in their campaigns for re-election. So a Democratic takeover in the Senate, while not entirely impossible, would be a political miracle of sorts and a really remarkable event. The House of Representatives, which has been under Republican control for quite a few years now, is a different matter. And the House, in contrast to the Senate, as you probably know, districts' lines are redrawn now quite regularly to cement the partisan advantage of the party in power in each particular state. So in the state of Texas, for example, the Republicans control and they redraw the district lines to maximize the number of Republican seats. In California or Maryland, it's the Democrats who do the same. And the result of this process of gerrymandering is that you have a particular kind of political math which specifies that the party in control must gain, the party challenging the party in control must gain something more than a majority to have a significant effect on the outcome. And in this case, it's probably 54 or 55%. The Democrats can get below 54 or 55% of the total popular vote, then the Republicans likely hold on to their seats. If they go above that, then there's an entire wave that happens in the dam breaks and many, many seats will fall. Gerrymandering does not make votes go away. It simply changes the probability of election in a particular district. A peculiar thing that's affecting this outcome is that although the Republicans hold that advantage nationally, they don't hold it in every state. They don't hold it in California. They don't hold it in New Jersey. They don't hold it in New York. And there you have small numbers of Republican representatives whose seats are very much in danger. And it may well be, and the general consensus at now, is that the Democrats have both a national edge in the House races and an edge in these vulnerable races in the states they actually control as a whole, and that therefore it is quite likely that the very possible, maybe even probable, that the Democrats will pick up the 25 or 26 seats that they need to take over the House of Representatives. What that will mean in practice, I think, is anybody's guess. The White House does not have an enormous legislative agenda, so far as I'm aware, so it probably doesn't make a lot of difference to them. A Democratic House would be able to launch investigations, but not push them through, not push impeachment, for example, through a Republican Senate. Some of the major, most important things like court appointments and foreign policy remain very much in the hands of the Senate. The battle that just occurred over Judge Kavanaugh was an excruciating demonstration that in the Senate, one has a very strong, almost mafia-like control over the Republican membership, that they're willing to elevate someone who was as plainly unfit as Brett Kavanaugh was to the Supreme Court for a lifetime appointment, is just a sign of the raw political power that money and political leverage have over members of the United States Senate in the present environment. That will bring us to 2020. And I'll just wrap up on that. I think it's exceedingly interesting. In 2020, a factor will come back into play that was in play in 2016, and that's Bernie Sanders. You said that my consultancy with the People's Republic of China was very successful. My advisory role with Senator Sanders was not quite so successful in 2016. But we may have another run in a couple of years. Sanders will be old, 78, but no sign of physical or mental impairment there. He continues to be the most popular politician in the country. And the Democratic alternative to him is, could be anybody, could be any of a large number of figures, none of whom have any national exposure at all. None of whom have ever run in a national race unless an even the elderly Joe Biden or John Kerry gets in which case you've got two or three old white men contending for that nomination. But amongst the younger figures, they're all state or local, they're basically statewide politicians, California and New York, and in states which do not have any reach out to the rest of the country, out to the areas that Donald Trump won in 2016. So I'm inclined to think it's at least possible that it will be Sanders and Trump in 2020. And that brings me to the one thing I want to talk about just very quickly, about the relationship between inequality and election outcomes in the U.S. Based upon my own work. Given that Trump ran in 2016 as a populist, one might have thought that he would do better in states where inequality was a big problem than in states where it was not. And we did some work to measure the movement of economic inequality on a state-by-state and year-by-year basis. The results are mapped out on this diagram with a proportionate change in inequality in structures of pay, but it's a good proxy for other forms of inequality on the horizontal axis, and the share of the vote that went to Secretary Clinton on the vertical axis. So the higher her share, the more likely it is that she would win the state, and with the state, the entire electoral college vote of that state. And what you see is, I think, very interesting. Of the 14 states where inequality rose the most, and we marked those states according to the size of their electoral college, their share in the electoral college, the number of electors. All 14 states with large increases of inequality are blue diamonds, or states that the Democratic candidate won in 2016, every single one of them. And the preponderance of states with low increases in inequality are states that Donald Trump won. Those are the red circles. And what is happening in the U.S. is, this is a pulling apart of the country on the grounds of economic diversity and inequality. Why are the unequal states more democratic? I think the answer to that is, structurally, the Democratic Party has become a party of two extremes of the income distribution. On the one hand, wealthy urban professionals who tend to be liberal in their social attitudes and progressive in their lifestyles and so forth, and who live in environments dominated by Democrats and tend to vote Democratic out of conviction and habit. And on the other hand, lower income immigrants, minority communities, lower income working class in some areas who vote Democratic for economic or reasons, or for reasons related to the party's historic commitment to civil rights, voting rights, and so forth, and immigrant rights. And when you have a state where those two factors together make a plurality, that's a Democratic state. California, New York, very strong. In states which tend to be suburban, rural, have low minority populations, and not to have high-income finance, technology, and other high-income activities, those states are both more egalitarian and Republican. So it's a situation where the Democrats are in the tails of the distribution, the Republicans are in the center, which gives you a very interesting problem. As the country becomes more unequal, that strengthens the Democrats, but in areas which become less unequal because industrial high-income industries are going out, that strengthens the Republicans. And what you see here is actually the pattern goes so far you can even detect movement in this sort of an analytical framework. On the one hand, the states that Trump won that gave him the election in 2016. The crucial ones, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, are states where inequality has grown little or may even be declining. So their basis for being democratic is eroding over time. Whereas the states of the South, and there are many of them on the red circles here, including the very largest one, which is where I live, which is Texas, they are all states which have growing minority populations, growing cities, with the same urban, democratic, liberal populations that every other American city has, and they are moving to the Democratic column. But the irony for the Democrats is that the states that Trump won have already flipped. The states that are moving in their direction are not ready to flip yet. And so in 2020, it will take a major set of problems to unseat the Republicans from the White House. I'm not going to predict that those problems will be there. I think that the economy will continue to be strong. And I don't think the long-term consequences of an extremely aggressive trade and financial policy will yet have been felt. In Trump's second term, I think all bets are off. I can't imagine that a recovery will last past the end of his second term. I can't imagine that we can continue with an extremely aggressive approach to the rest of the world without the rest of the world finding ways to counter our moves. I find it very difficult to imagine that the dollar can survive 6 years more of a go-it-alone policy. I could be wrong about that, but it does seem to me that that for the moment it looks as though the powers that be are in a strong position in the short run and will pay the price for it further down the road. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, you have time for